Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food and beverage radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Boys.
Guys, what a busy time of year, right?
Man, oh man.
Jeez.
I know, yeah. Happy Dia de los Muertos, everybody.
Absolutely.
Happy Dia de Muertos.
Yeah, and happy multiple Halloweens. I think we had five in a row.
Yeah.
Right? When exactly. Halloween falls on a Tuesday, it's Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, Monday night. Yeah.
Yep, for sure.
Let's do it again tonight. Why not? It's been fun.
Yeah, might as well.
Let's
get
rolling.
Totally.
We'll just keep it rolling.
Souther, you've been kind of on the road. I've been on the road doing some whiskey festivals. You were at Chartreuse last week.
I was.
If I remember correctly, yeah. I mean, tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, I mean
I've been
listen.
Five, 6 years ago, and I had a blast. It was a really important trip for me, not only in my career, but just personally. It was a very moving trip, so I want to hear what your experience was like.
Yeah, man, I'd say the same. You know, it was quite, as you might imagine, as you don't have to imagine, you were there, but as the listener might imagine, kind of spiritual, you know, this very soft, quiet monastery. You know, we didn't get to go inside. You know, lay people are not allowed inside, but we walked all around the monastery up on the hill and looked down over it. Got to visit the distilleries, talk to the makers. Didn't get to see any monks this trip. Apparently, the new Father Superior is a little bit more strict than the former one, so he doesn't allow the brothers or the monks to interact with lay people. But I think the real thing that I took away from it is this thing that's going on with Chartreuse out there is simply a scare. The way they likened it is it's almost like a bank run. They're making 5% more Chartreuse than they made in previous years. And granted, 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot of increase. So there is no shortage. What's happening and has been happening is we, the people, have been buying and hoarding. So that's creating a shortage that then makes people want to buy and hoard. And then it's a snake that eats itself from there. I think that if we all just calm down and take a beat, we'll realize that there's plenty of Chartreuse to go around. And I got to taste a lot of cool stuff. We can get into that at another time, but one of the things I got to taste was what's called une chartreuse, which is like sort of the original formula. They only make 120 bottles a year. So pretty special to even get, you know, a half an ounce of that juice. Also, I learned what I didn't know, which is they only make three things. They only make the elixir, the yellow, and the green. Each of the three involves all 130 botanicals, just in different levels. And then everything they make from there is a blend of those three things.
Huh.
So like the 1605, the 147, the MOF, which are all releases you can only get over there. Plus, of course, the products that we know, plus the VEP. Those are all just blends of those three base things. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
One of my big takeaways, Souther, was that, that as far as Chartreuse goes, yes, that's correct. But also, I didn't know until I went there that they make a Genipi.
Well, I brought that back. It's Genipi. Delicious. Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. Which I was going to say, you know, to anyone who's like freaking out about Chartreuse and, you know, like, okay, just like branch out a little bit, try Genipi, try some other herbal liqueur that's like maybe a little more cost effective. Like, you know, it was kind of like the same thing with Pappy Van Winkle like 15 years ago. It's like everyone just started hoarding it because they're like, oh, they don't make a lot of it. And then it's like, you know, you just kind of like, we did it to ourselves, you know? So yeah, we love Chartreuse.
Yeah, of course. We're starting to see that. I think I mentioned on another episode, I saw a bottle at retail of the VEP for $1,300.
That's insane.
Holy shit. Like, where was that?
Ludicrous. I saw it was an online retail, so, you know, it wasn't a store I was walking into, but the bottom line is they understand that the demand is getting a little bit scary out there, so they can depress prices, you know? And I'm hopeful that we don't get into a situation with chartreuse, like you mentioned with Pappy, or just bourbon in general, where we suddenly have, you know, a sort of, you know, all these third party sellers who are hoarding and selling just to make a buck. But time will tell. But this is, that's a brand that's been around forever. You know what I mean? Many brands are out there having to kind of reinvent themselves over and over. I think chartreuse just has to get rediscovered over and over, right?
Sounds right.
Once you've been around that long, you've effectively been around forever.
That's right. Yeah. We're glad that you're back, Souther. So
thank you.
I can't wait to see you in person and try some of the stuff you brought back. I'm sure I have a lot of the same stuff
at the
Grand Army Bar, but I'm glad you got to go. Good.
I brought back my limited. Right, I borrowed someone else's suitcase to bring back a little bit more. And just a side note for me, and next time I see you, Damon, we'll drink this for sure. I bought myself a bottle of Armagnac from my year of birth.
Oh, great.
Which is, you know, 54 years ago this month. So
nice.
Pretty cool. Anyways, Greg, we already heard her charming voice a little bit. Who is in the virtual studio with us today?
Well, in the virtual studio with us today for Halloween part, I don't know, 6, 7, whatever we're calling it now.
Well, more for Dia de los Muertos, I think, right?
Dia de los Muertos. Yeah, exactly. Well, no, this is where it goes a little south of the border. We get to have some fun with it. And I'm excited to welcome Ava Pelkser from
Doma Gate.
I did Halloween part 6 pretty hard last night, if anyone can't tell. From Doma Gate. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, Ava. We're really, really happy to have you in the studio, even if my brain isn't quite processing it yet.
No, I'm so happy to be here. I love the longevity of this show and how it's grown. I've witnessed it and been a part of it through Southern Damon, of course. So I'm very happy to be here. And if I may recommend, for those of you that have mezcal in the room, we do indulge in what we call a mezcalito every so often in Oaxaca. You know, a little copita in the morning just helps the brain start functioning again after 7 Halloweens in a row or whatever.
You know, sure. with Halloween falling on a Tuesday, does this mean it goes on? Is there Halloween this weekend coming up as well? Like, how many Halloweens we got?
I don't think so. I think so. Dia de Muertos we have, of course, and then we just kind of start putting up the Christmas lights and the menorahs and all the other wonderful deep winter holidays that are.
Yeah, sorry, Thanksgiving. You've been preempted again this year.
So I actually really forgot about tried.
They don't have Thanksgiving in Mexico. That's uniquely us.
No, I completely spaced on Thanksgiving. That's very funny. So all of us are in the Smooth Brain Club today. I love it.
I mean, it's wonderful. Brains. I love some mezcal at Thanksgiving. It's, it helps soothe the big meal, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Mezcal is a digestive. I carry the torch for that. Same with mezcal as a pairing for food. You know, there's a complexity and an acid there that functions similar to wine. And so it's great to have next to like fatty, flavorful, meaty dishes and many other things too.
Yeah, but of course.
That's a little kind of tip for the upcoming giant meal holiday.
Right. I've never liked cranberry sauce until I had mezcal on the side of it.
Ooh. That sounds lovely.
Yeah, I
mean, let's just fold some in, right? Let's make cranberry sauce with mezcal.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, it was at Prime Meats about like 15 years ago, because what we said we were open on Thanksgiving Day, and like I was thinking one year, I was like, just like what's traditional? What's served with like a traditional like American Thanksgiving dinner with like turkey and stuffing and all that stuff? And I was just like looking around the back bar, and I'm like, I see a bottle of Vita, and I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go.
Yeah,
it's gonna work. And it was amazing. And so
I mean, turkey and mezcal go together. That's pechuga, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, it can be chicken or Iberico, you know, a little jamon in there.
Sure.
From us at least.
Yeah. Totally.
Ava, talk to us a little bit about your job. Like, how did you come to be the position you are with this, you know, kind of storied already brand?
Yeah, well, so 30 years ago, Ron Cooper brought this company to the U.S. I entered more recently, about 9 years ago, actually, at this point.
Crazy.
But I know it's been a journey here, too. And it's interesting because I came in at a time where I became a steward of the brand through its evolution into full ownership under Preneur Card. So as of January, my title is the Global Education Manager. I work directly for Preneur Card because now Del Negue is a part of that multinational. But I work on only Del Negue. And so I basically bring the culture of Del Negue, the history of Del Negue from my 9 years of managing the East Coast market for the company as an educator, ambassador. You know, we did a lot of things under what at that time was called the WEZ role. J-U-E-Z is the Spanish word for judge. And that's what was on our business cards. So I was the East Coast WEZ. There was a West Coast WEZ. Still only five of us.
The WEZ got that riz.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, this exactly was what the point of having that title was. It was to start the conversation, right? Because Del Negue has always championed the fact that you cannot sell or separate the liquid itself from the culture that it comes from, right? So the culture of the partner producing families that we continue to work with has to be always a part of the conversation of what we're doing on the US side with this liquid and this green bottle. So, you know, if I walk into a place and say I'm Del Negue's East Coast WEZ, we immediately talk about what a WEZ is. And in Oaxacan circles and these indigenous communities, the WEZ is a position of honor. It is the person who is handed the bottle of mezcal by the producer. And the WEZ pours for everyone first, pours for themselves last, and then leads the group in a toast. And this is very sort of traditional and ritualistic, and it's the way that mezcal is consumed in these communities. You know, now the way that demand for mezcal has grown globally, of course, there's lots of other ways to enter the culture, namely cocktails. That's why we're here today, because of one of our newest expressions with Del Negue that's geared towards that new to mezcal customer. But, you know, all roads lead back to the center core of the culture, which was a door opened by the WEZ title. But now I've moved out of the field. You know, I've moved up in terms of responsibilities and my scope. And so I oversee the education program that kind of takes Del Negue and the way that we teach mezcal global. So we actually have, I think, 15 agave ambassadors globally. So literally Mexico, UK, Australia, New Zealand, Italy, France, these wonderful young people who look after Del Negue and also the other agave brands within Pernod, Alto Sanobio primarily. And so for them to be now stewards of the brand, I am essentially a steward of the education program that they go into their markets with.
I mean, that's incredible. And
so I definitely want to ask, like, what, you know, I mean, you've been with this brand for 9 years now, which is incredible. And I was almost, just kind of, preemptively.
I mean, happy. Effectively a third of the life of the company itself, right? So like you're part of it.
We're in our, yeah. I'm almost OG, although, you know, there are much more OGs than me.
we'll give you the honorary title here. You can put it next to Wes.
I appreciate that. Star.
But I was just thinking back to like where mezcal was 10 years ago. Well, excuse me, almost 9 years ago. And I just remember how it was like blowing up. And it's still kind of, you know, the benchmark of a success story for introducing a new spirit to the market. Like, you know, every year we see headlines about like, is this going to be this summer's like the next mezcal? Wasn't the summer of sherry, guys. It was wrong for the seventh year in a row, but I have a really good feeling about it next year.
Yeah.
But I wonder now that the spirit has gotten so big and gone so far, kind of like where do you go? It almost feels as if you're kind of at the, you know, Alexander the Great, there are no more worlds to conquer thing. What does one do to innovate now in the year 2023 when we're talking about mezcal?
Well, that's a huge question, and I'm happy to give my perspective on it, but don't let anyone tell you that they can just give you a tight little package of how to answer that, because it is such a complicated, nuanced, fascinating, exciting thing. But there's just a lot going on in the mezcal world and a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities. One thing I will say that in the US, it feels like mezcal is huge. Everyone kind of is aware of it or wants to participate in it, which is so great. but there are many worlds to conquer, to take your quote. And conquer is not the right word. We want to sort of bring people along on this journey of Mezcal. But honestly, the rest of the world is very, very small in terms of consumption of Mezcal. So there are some other markets like the UK, some parts of Europe, even Australia, where it's just starting to kind of be a part of a cocktail landscape. So there really is a lot of the world that is now just waking up to Mezcal because of all the reasons. I mean, geography being one, right? U.S. is the biggest market for both tequila and Mezcal. We're right next to our neighbors in Mexico. And we're what's called a very mature market. So, you know, where we were, and Damon and Sether, I know you are kind of stewards of the mixology movement to some degree. So where the U.S. was 15 years ago, many metropolitan areas around the globe are there now today, right? They're just starting to get into craft cocktails, craft spirits, artisanal spirits of provenance. And so there's a lot more of the story to be told across the world. And, you know, we as Del Maguey have a pretty amazing and unique perspective on that because of our almost 30 years, right? And because of what we stand for and the platform that we have now being a part of Pernod Ricard. So the acquisition, the sort of transitional period from when Pernod Ricard bought the majority share of Del Maguey, that was about 5 or 6 years ago, was completed by January of this year, which is a typical transition period for this kind of merger. That was the first time that a multinational had invested like this in a traditional brand. And to my knowledge, it really still is unique in that way. Because a company as big as Pernod Ricard, if we think about other big players, Diageo, Campari, et cetera, generally speaking, commercial spirits, you know, have bigger reach, have bigger volume, probably turn more profit. And so it's generally speaking unusual to see a company choose to invest in something unique like Del Maguey and carry it as a crown jewel. So again, there are many sort of unique perspectives that affords us as Del Maguey, but I would say one of the biggest things is that we carry this responsibility because anything that Del Maguey does and anything Del Maguey has done since its inception in 95 gets followed. Like it becomes a template or a blueprint for how to do business with this kind of spirit or the traditional mezcal specifically. And, for that reason, that visibility that's just been increased by being a part of Pernod Ricard means that we have to be very intentional with how we bring this story and bring this spirit to the world as it grows and as demand for it grows.
Yeah, I would ask, like, with the acquisition and being more of a global brand, how is that impacting the makers? I know that Del Maguey deals, you know, kind of directly with small makers, small families, and you want to keep that authenticity. How do you balance that scoreboard?
Yeah. And so we still work with the same producers and with the addition of the new facility on Ashokopan Puebla. So the short answer in terms of how those producers are impacted is I have a feeling they would say they're happy to have more business. Vida Puebla, which is the new expression that we came out with in April of this year, is a departure from kind of the classic Del Maguey story in many ways. But number one, that spirit is a 40% ABV mezcal. We have never brought a 40% ABV mezcal to the world. Previously, what we recommended to use in cocktails and to kind of be the bridge into the category was Vida, formerly known as Vida. Now it's known as Vida Clásico. And I'm bringing that in, Souther, because, you know, our family in San Luis del Rio, so the head of the family is Graciano, his adult Marcos has joined him in the family business as of many years ago. They have a scaled palenque where they produce Vida Clásico. And they actually hit a ceiling of being able to produce artisanally at volume. They really couldn't do any more than what they were already doing without changing the process, which they did not want to do. And that is where the project of Vida Puebla was born, because we have to meet the global demand to some degree. which is growing. We need to work in a facility for that liquid that can be scaled even into the future. And so Ashokapan presented that opportunity. Steve Olson, of course, a partnership with Pernod Ricard, worked on that project for about 2 years. And then we finally brought the first bottles to the U.S. It's only launched in one or two other markets around the world this year. And so that facility, so every other Del Maguey producer up until now is a family, a farmer family producer, basically a palanquero who is upholding a family tradition, right? And that's what we celebrate with the Taste of Place, the single village concept. With Ashokapan, it's still a single village concept, but that is an intentionally built facility for Del Maguey. So basically it's called Vida Puebla because it takes the building blocks of the production style in San Luis del Rio, which is espadine, natural fermentation, copper pot stills, and brings it to a modern, we call it like a state-of-the-art palenque. So there are elements that are borrowing from that traditional process, but then there's also modern elements that create the opportunity for what I call responsible scaling. So the goal is for that facility to become an actually green certified sustainable operation. We are not there yet. And, you know, I always say that we really need to check ourselves, check our friends and colleagues when we talk about sustainability because of the immense amount of greenwashing in our industry and others as well. So again, responsible is the word that I like to use because it is very important to us to be a leader in sustainable mezcal production and volume. And those things are very hot button words in our sector right now for all the right reasons.
Well, that's really awesome to hear. I mean, like, you're right. That it's a really important part of our business these days to produce responsibly, but also to me, mezcal is probably the most important spirit when it comes to that, because it really is about families and tradition, and it can really get, and we have seen, unfortunately, a lot of that happening even more recently in the mezcal market. You know, there's like, it seems like there's like 100 new brands every week, like more brands than bars that Souther opens every week. So it's like, it's one of those things. It's like, how do you, so, I mean, he opens a lot of bars every week. But
not untrue.
It's, as he should.
But like, how do you like monitor and control like the story and the production? It's like, it sounds like you're doing it. You know, I think that's one of the main concerns that a lot of us have with like modern mezcal production is like keeping it traditional and keeping it, you know, keeping it in the hands of the families who have been producing it for, you know, generations.
Well, and therein lies the real challenge, right? There's a tension there between wanting a traditional product and wanting to access a beautiful heritage that you don't have in your backyard, but also wanting that wherever you are, right? There's a conversation to be had on a different episode about global capitalism and really like, how do we navigate that when we are stewarding artisanal products of heritage into, you know, the hands of global demand. So, you know, to go back to a couple of things you said, one, I'm going to just reframe a little bit that yes, there are tons of mezcals out there, tons now. It is growing almost exponentially in terms of the number of brands you can access. There is, you know, the commercial end of that spectrum is also growing, which can be disappointing for those of us who really champion artisanal spirits. But the door has also been open to very small brands coming in, you know, even spirits that are not certified under the DO and are destilado de agaves. You know, those wouldn't have had a market maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And now you can go to bars and ask for like, you know, something from, for example, Cinco Cepinos. Those are friends of ours. And some of those producers either don't want to get certified or cannot get certified. You know, so there's been opportunity established for both ends of the spectrum. So I think it's important to remember the positive in addition to the complexities that are now present. But going back to with Del Maguey, our portfolio is huge. I know Souther and Damon, you know this, Greg, you might as well, but we have about 25 expressions and we call all those bottles together a green wall, right? And Vida Puebla is an artisanal mezcal. It is also an accessible, approachable mezcal. So it is something that's made for a new to mezcal consumer, but granted made by Steve Olson. So he was like, if we're bringing a 40% mezcal to market, it's going to be the best 40% out there. But for us, like, the goal is not to stop there, you know, like maybe you order, we call it a twist on a classic, right? A way to kind of introduce a very generic consumer to mezcal. Insert mezcal in your usual order. You usually get a gin and tonic, try a mezcal and tonic. You know, do you normally get, let's hope they normally get a Negroni, right? Then you're already not even really your average consumer, but why don't you make that a mezcal Negroni with Vita Puebla?
These days, I mean, you know, Trader Joe's has
a lot. You can get a Negroni at Applebee's. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So the point is, like, once you get that drink, though, you don't stop there. We don't want it to be like, cool, you've had the Vita Puebla drink. Congratulations. It's more like, now you've built that bridge. Like, we have now what we call the Vita Collection. Before it was just Vita Clásico. Now we have Vita Puebla, Vita Clásico, you know, still made 42% in San Luis del Rio. And then Vita de Muertos, which is basically a 45% ABV edition of Vita Clásico, which also has a different flavor profile because it's related to the holiday. But so now, instead of one entry point into what we call the mezcal journey, right, the idea would be like, you have the cocktail, you have a little mezcal meat, then you start to get into traditional ABV mezcals, wild varietals. You know, you just keep going over the course of however long that takes you personally. But instead of just the one Vita Clásico, we now have three different options depending on who you are, what kind of drinker you are, where in the world you are. So the idea is that it's a door opener. It's a stepping stone into understanding the culture, right?
And you kind of hit the nail on the head too. You know, most consumers these days, and for a long time, as long as we mixed one ingredient with another, I mean, people mostly drink their spirits. They discover their spirits through a cocktail, right? So
exactly.
That was one of the cool things about Vita when it came out. What was it, like 2010?
It was literally 2010. And at that time, I tell young bartenders and I sound like a, you know, like just like spinning old tales, like an old lady, but I love it. Because I'm like, there was a time when no one even knew. They were like, what's a mezcal cocktail? You know, and Vita Clásico, formerly known as Vita, changed the game. I mean, that was really, the turning point. And you guys knew that at the ground level.
Right. It was quality. Absolutely. It was affordable. It was priced to put into cocktails. It was
great on its own still, though.
It was great on its own.
Really exactly.
Important thing to note.
It had all of the.
It has
when I'm talking in the past. It has all the hallmarks of a good mezcal. It's not. It's not as polarizing as many mezcals are, you know. I think, we have to do a lot of polarizing things in our world. Gin, I think, is right in there. Mezcal, for sure. Scotches can be in there as well. And I think that, let's talk a little bit about that. Like, there's some greater approachability to this new expression. But let's talk about what you mean when you say that. What's not approachable about mezcal, and how does it polarize people?
So honestly, even Vita Clásico is a lot for some people. And Vita Puebla, you know, the kind of people that are interested in mezcal today versus 10 or 15 years ago, just don't really have necessarily a palate for craft spirits at all. You know, they are coming into mezcal because mezcal is enjoying this kind of almost commercial popularity. And so, you know, all three of us, probably Greg, I don't know you very well yet, but, you know, we're reaching for the complex stuff, right? Like, we've just been drinking craft spirits for a long time. But understanding where that particular consumer is coming from, you know, Vita Puebla, if you put it next to Vita Clásico, like, all of us would probably reach for Clásico because it's got a little bit more structure. It has more of that roasted agave, a little bit of smoke even on it. It's a higher ABV. That 2 percentage points doesn't sound like a lot, but it is meaningful on the palate. And so Vita Puebla is just like literally a soft, lovely, still structured mezcal, has a beautiful dry finish, but it's soft. It's approachable. Those are two words I would use. I also like to kind of call it in my bartending circles, you know, it's like the aperitif for us because we're used to drinking like 47% espadines and lots of other things. And so something that's 40% is going to feel very easy, very light. And so that's a big part of it. But the other side is the price point. I mean, we are now looking at a world where commercial mezcal, like we've been calling it the race to the bottom for a really long time with Del Maguey, but commercial mezcal has really, how do I put it? They've achieved a goal, unfortunately, which is establishing that mezcal can be like not even competitively priced, but like on par with everything else that you might have in a well behind the bar, like a well vodka, well gin, and a well whiskey. There are reasons why those can be cheap. To me, it's still not applicable to something that's made from a raw material that takes 7 years to mature and comes from, you know, just a very different world, literally and figuratively. But that's the world we live in. So one of the things that Del Maguey has to do now is adapt that world. Like for a long time, Del Maguey was establishing kind of the path of mezcal. And now it's so much bigger than that we have to adapt and continue to protect our market share as well as grow our market share. And in order to do that, we have to consider price point. And Vita Pueblo is not inexpensive, but it is competitively priced. And Vita Costigo has had to take at least a couple dollar price increase in all U.S. markets. In some markets, it's even more like $4 or $5 because of all the reasons that prices go up. I mean, basically, it starts at the raw material, but the style of production just can't stay low in terms of what that bottle cost is. And so Vita Puebla is meant to fulfill kind of that original Vita Classico price point and offer something that is, I don't like to say inexpensive, but affordable.
Right.
No, I mean, I think that's important. I think that in our world, I think it's very easy to, you know, I mean, because at the point that all of us are, like, we get handed this stuff for free. And, you know, we're also in a spot where even if we don't, like, we love this stuff enough that I don't even really look at the prices when I order these things at bars. And I know that, you know, Sutter and Damon, you don't either. We talk about that a lot.
Blind in my right eye.
Yeah,
exactly. I know. I don't see what's over there. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. I want it. I'll go for it. Because it's a thing that we're willing to, in just the way that we approach the world and in our field, it's a thing that we're willing to spend on and know that this costs what it costs and I'm not going to get butthurt about it. But I think it's important to also know that if this is a category that you want to keep growing and keep introducing to consumers, that that's, you know, you do have to be conscientious of the fact that not everyone approaches their drinks that way.
Yeah.
And that's, again, like, it's like starting off the conversation of like, okay, we're meeting you where you are. This is our hand extended. And then again, the goal is for people to go on this journey, like start understanding the why behind how many bottles we have, like the infinite, you know, flavor profiles you can access with this spirit category. And then the why behind why it's expensive as you move into smaller batch production.
Well, I was going to say that, like, you know, you just said about 5 minutes ago, you said something about understanding the consumer and what they're looking for, but it's also like understanding the people who make this stuff too, because like it was like maybe 2 weeks before COVID hit, Souther and I went on a trip to Mezcal land, you know, well, cause we were not just
it's
in Oaxaca,
like Disneyland kind of was better.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of toured all around the area and it was amazing. And it was really, I mean, to kind of like bring this full circle from what you're talking about with chartreuse, it's like a spiritual journey, you know, and like understanding going to the palenques and hanging out with the families and like working like a little bit of production with them and just like understanding like how it's made and like the kind of like modesty of production and facilities, but also just understanding how much passion goes into it. It's like, it's a two-way street, right? You've got the consumer trying to understand what their wants and needs are, but then also the magic really happens when they understand what the product is all about. And to me, like Del Maguey has always been that. I mean, like I'm from the Southwest. I've known Mr. Cooper for a very, very long time, and I've heard some really great stories. We've shared some good ones, and I spent a lot of time in Santa Fe my whole life, and I, you know, it's, he's been an artist there forever, and I heard a really good one about the kind of advent of the Iberico mezcal.
When he hid from the FedEx guy? Yeah, that's a good story.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. I would have done the same. We're cut from the same cloth for sure. But you know, it takes someone who's passionate about it. We've talked a lot about the some of the brands or sort of the labels rather, you know, talk about the Vita Clásico and the Vita Puebla. I have the bottle of Puebla at home. It's awesome. I was really happy. I mean, I got the email about it, like, I don't know, if that feels like 6 months ago, and then it finally showed up in the mail, and I was like, yes, all right. You know, some like the Chichicapa was like one of the first LMAs I ever had, and it like blew me away. And especially, you know, like when we went on that trip, I mean, you hear about Espadín and Barril and maybe Arequeño and some of these other varietals of agave, but it's like, I think that if those people who are interested in mezcal, it's like, there's, you know, when you say listening to the customer and seeing what they want, it's like, they should go out and, you know, go find the green wall and try a few of them, you know, and there's going to be something there for everyone. I mean, everyone is a mezcal drinker. They don't know it yet, you know? Right. And that's just
kind of, I love what you just said there. I agree with you that everyone is a mezcal. It's like saying you don't like music. Like, you like mezcal. You just haven't had fun that you like. Right.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, those guys in Times Square. You like comedy? You like to laugh?
No. No. Absolutely not.
Like, how could you say no to that? But yeah, there is really something for everyone at this point, especially. But to your point, I mean, Chichicapa has been in the U.S. since the 90s, like literally one of the first two bottles of Del Maguey that came here. And it's really interesting to think about the kind of evolution of where we are now, where now we're kind of going out and saying, we get it, you know, but like, come along on this ride with us. And that can be a very exciting place. Like when we first launched Vita Puebla in April, we did what's called a blitz. I'm sure you guys know what that is, but in case some of your listeners don't, the team gets together in certain big markets and just kind of goes out over the course of 2 or 3 days to educate and sell the bottle and introduce it. And we met with a lot of bartenders, you know, and us, like those of us on Del Maguey who've been with the brand for a while, you know, we're all from bartending backgrounds, but we bartended like 10 years ago, right? So now this new generation of bartenders, we were like, huh, like, I wonder if they're going to be interested in Vita Puebla because Vita Clásico is so beloved. You know, we all know all the great reasons why we love that bottle. And it was really interesting because there's been a sea change, it seems, in the trade community where the pandemic had a lot to do with it, but there's just a lot of like young people who are truly new to craft cocktails and, you know, very enthusiastic, but there doesn't seem to be just like a huge amount of mentorship happening right now behind the bar. And so they're figuring it out, but their palates are still getting acclimated to really more challenging spirits. And a lot of them were like, you know what, I actually prefer Vita Puebla. This is really good to Vita Clásico. And I was like, it's so cool to think about how these bartenders are really that. Yeah, but like they're almost the consumer that Vita Puebla is made for. You know, the idea of like, because they're looking at Chichicapa and being like, oh, that's, you know, there's an intimidation if you don't know what it is. Also like 46% and it's a complex, high acid, unaged spirit, you know? So we did hear a lot of like, oh, I don't really drink a lot of mezcal. I don't really drink mezcal. And they tried Vita Puebla and it opened the door. Like I had this great, just like a quick story because I'm obsessed with it because there was one bar that we went to. I went in there with a sales rep and there were three women. It's like three magi. But there was one who was like a total agave nerd. She was like our people. The manager was aware of agave and had a good vocabulary around it, but didn't necessarily drink it all the time. And then there was a very new young woman who had just started bartending there. And she was like in age and in experience much farther behind. All super lovely people. And the young woman was like, oh, I don't drink mezcal. it's too smoky. I don't like it. So she tried Vita Puebla and was like, huh, maybe I can like Mezcal. And you know me, I ended up, it was like a Vita Puebla visit, but I had like six other bottles with me that I requested from the distributor. And one of them was like Tobola and Aroqueño. So we went in some pretty deep territory, but this girl, Vita Puebla opened the door for her. And by the end, she was like, you know what? Aroqueño was my favorite. That's an amazing Mezcal. And this happened in one tasting. I was just like, that's what should happen. That's what this whole thing is about.
Yeah, I think we encourage people.
Just a quick note, Aroqueño is 49%, you know, a more rare varietal. It's distilled in clay. Still in the days, Aroqueño is a clay-still distillation. So it's just super high acid, minerally, lots of things going on in there. And it's very hot. It's just not a beginner mezcal, typically speaking.
Yeah, no.
Just to contextualize that.
I mean, I think what we do at the bars, what I encourage my teams to do, of course, is to do exactly what you're talking about with our consumer as often as we can. Of course, you know, you can't get to every single person when the heat is on and we're busy, but we want to show you stuff. We want to, and showing you stuff doesn't mean giving you a taste of one thing. Showing you stuff means giving you a few things at the time. So you have a comparison, you know, you have a sort of a litmus in front of you and you can compare and contrast. And I think that that's what really, truly, as you have said, opens the doors. And especially as mentioned, you have the green wall. If you can go to a place that carries many of your expressions, then you can really walk someone through, you can guide them. You can be their sort of guide and Sherpa them through this experience of Mezcal. I cracked open my bottle. I'm the only one who's smart enough to bring my bottle to the virtual studio today.
I was evicted. So I don't know about public drinking in Princeton. They would be on me very quickly.
Yeah.
But I'm with you in spirit.
In spirit. Yes. But we should note Eva's coming to us from a park bench. You're sitting literally outside in Princeton, bundled up because it's kind of chilly out there. Cause you got evicted from the room you were in that you're planning to do the podcast from. You didn't know that you had to reserve the room. That's fine.
Going well here, guys.
Listen,
going real well.
Listen, it's a brand new month. Here
happy
we go.
Halloween, everyone.
You know, we're moving into holiday territory. But I'm smelling this one right out of the bottle, and you know, it's interesting that you mentioned earlier, and maybe that is what stuck it in my head. But my first, you know, smell of it, and this is the first spirit I've smelled this morning, other than my typical Underberg. It kind of gave me a wine vibe. Smelling right from the bottle, right? When I pulled the cork.
Oh, I love that.
When I pulled the cork and smelled it from the bottle itself, it kind of was like, oh, this kind of has a wine vibe. And I drank a lot of wine while I was in France. And so like you mentioned, you know, mezcal with food. And so maybe that's all on my mind as well. Once it's in my glass, my tiny Yarai. You ever see these tiny Yarai? It costs.
I know, it's adorable.
It costs twice as much as an actual Yarai. I use them in like videos and stuff. So I'm sipping from one of those. And talk to me about what's going on in this bottle and what makes it different and special from the Vita Clásico now.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, first of all, we're in a different state, right? So Vita Clásico is made in San Luis del Rio in Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. So we're now across the border in Achapulpan, Puebla. So it's at the base of a volcano that is called Popo for short, Popo. It's very difficult to pronounce for me, at least the full name. There's a lot of consonants, but the locals call it Popo. And so it's like just a different terroir. But I would say that there is intention behind the flavor profile in a way that does not happen when we look at mezcal made in a palenque, in a family palenque based on family traditions. And so this is meant to be, to have complexity. So what you're smelling, and I like the idea of like, I was like, okay, why would there be a wine vibe? Like one of the notes that we pick up on is actually stone fruit. Mm-hmm. So we have one of like the official tasting notes that we distill down to is white peach. Mm-hmm. And if I think about like beautiful French wines, I mean, especially white wines, I don't know what you were drinking, but stone fruits tend to be a part of that flavor profile. And so that like brightness, that fruitiness is definitely there. But, you know, the hallmark of like what roasted agave tastes like is like there's a little bit of vegetal and there's a little bit of tropical fruit, and together they create, if you like were able to eat a piece of roasted agave or smell roasted agave like at the palenque, which you guys have, that's how we can describe it for those people who've never been around that particular raw ingredient. And so I would say that there is a little bit of green quality there, but again, it's very soft. Like we have flavor profiles in the portfolio that are super herbaceous, super herbal, or super like bell peppery. That's not happening here. But the way we call it is candied pine. So I love that flavor note, which actually came from Jen, who is our former West Coast Wes and now is officially a brand ambassador under Pernod Ricard based in LA. She's got an amazing palette, as all of our team does. But her note of candied pine, I think, is really lovely because there is like That's a cool. sweetness to it, but it's balanced by literally a little bit of pininess. Mm-hmm. And then, Souther, as you took your sips, you'll notice like great mezcal, artisanal to traditional, has balance. It has acid. It never just like dissipates on the end. You want it to have like a little bit of length at least. And that was a really important piece for us. And so I think we've been successful with dialing that in with this flavor profile. Like, you don't get aggressive acid. You know, again, we want it to be gentle, but it does travel along the palate, which for a 40% mezcal, you know, that's what we consider making it the best 40% mezcal that's accessible to us.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy drinking. I think I wasn't getting white peach as much as when I spilled directly from the bottle, you know, just up through the neck. I was getting apricot is what first jumped to my mind. But then once it's in the glass, it opens up a bit and I can smell the minerality, a little bit of that sort of roastiness. It does linger quite a bit longer than I expected it to at this lower proof. It's delicious. And I think, yeah, I definitely want to have it with food. I want to have some food.
It is lunchtime.
It's really,
it is lunchtime.
It's like an aperitif. You're doing it right. But yeah, one thing I want to call out too is like, even Vita Classico, you know, I don't think that smoke on mezcal is really real. There's like some roasty qualities. It should be in harmony with so many other things. But this especially, like, we know that that consumer who thinks that mezcal is not for them or thinks they don't like mezcal have internalized this idea that mezcal equals smoke. And so with this, there's a demonstration that, you know, smoke is not necessarily at all a part of conversation, right? I'm guessing that you're not getting any smoke No. off of this at all.
No.
Yeah.
Not really.
So I love that about it.
And that piney note that you mentioned does make this sound like it would be delightful with tonic, right? Mezcal and tonic sounds like the way
to go. Mezcal tonic or mezcal and ginger too, you know, sure. Like converting someone from a Moscow mule to a mezcal mule can happen really easily with this one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely. Mezcal and tonic is so easy. It's like you go to any bar and they can do that for you. So
right.
It's yeah. just like, there's your bridge.
Man, I mean, I'm so happy to have you back on the show. So happy to be tasting this. Too bad the fellas didn't bring their bottle, but you have them back at home, right? So you'll get to taste them.
Get back to it. Tonight.
Yeah,
you know, another great addition to the back bar that we can, you know, use to again coax people down that road. You know, I have a terria that's all tequila and mezcal, and it's mostly tequila because that's the easier entryway. But the people who come there who are interested and they climb that ladder with us, or we take them on that journey, or whatever way we want to put it. Like, this is another easy, as you said earlier in the show, stepping stone to show them what mezcal can be. So I appreciate it being out there. I'm already a fan.
Thank
one,
you.
One little copita's worth in, and I'm already a fan.
I love that, Souther. That means a lot coming from you. Thank you. And I'm really glad you were able to taste it today. I look forward to drinking some with you in person whenever we can make that happen.
Yeah, I'd love
maybe.
To. Well, maybe you could
the
come
next time we run into each other at Bar Goto.
Sure, or you could come do an education at the bar or something.
I would love that. Let's chat about that.
Get my team on board. Well, guys, unless you have anything else for Eva, I think we got to let her go. She's busy. We're busy. We've all got stuff to do. Anything more, gents?
I just want to say thanks for being on the show. It's been a while since we've chatted, and I miss you. It's good to see you on this this video feed. But you know, to echo what you're saying, can't wait to see you in person next time I'm out on the East Coast.
Yeah, or I'm out west. One of the two.
Or that. Yeah. Cool. Thanks. Yeah.
Well,
thank you all so much.
Yeah, I can't wait to again make some food with this, and maybe use some of my Desert Curse hot sauce, which includes habanero, pineapple, and mezcal, which is coming out soon.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm making a hot sauce, lady.
Yeah, you are. Give me some.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for this episode of the Speakeasy. Thanks for tuning in. Head over to heritageradionetwork.org. Click on the beating heart and donate to keep shows just like ours on the air. And Eva, thanks so much for being with us. And oh, real quickly, we forgot. I forgot. Where can people follow along with your hijinks? What's your Instagram handle and where can we?
My hijinks.
Yeah.
So it's my last name. First of all, Del McGinnis, for sure. And you'll find me through that because I repost my stories a lot. But my handle is Mescalter. So it's a combination of Mescal and my last name. There's like several Z's and C's in there. So I would recommend that once you guys post about this episode and tag me, your listeners can just hit that because spelling it out here and now is just not going to go well, I think, for anyone.
Mescalter for Ava Pelzer. I love it.
Love it.
All right. Well, thanks again. We loved having you on, and we look forward to you know, drinking some Vita with you out of little copitas. And in cocktails.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's about time. And thank you again. I really appreciate the time and the excellent questions.
You got it. Steegee.
Steegee Boo.
Steegee Boo. So you don't shun
the devil with your right. The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.